So today is Sefer Chinuch. We're going to do 338, 339, and 340, Bezrat Hashem. And what's today's date, just so I... On the tape here. April 15th. The Hebrew date is correct.
Week's. Oh. This is last week. Okay. Because, okay, so it's the 15th of April, and it is the 5th of Iyar.
Right. And the 5th of Iyar. Great. Hey, Iyar is actually Yom Ha'atzmaut, except for it's postponed to tomorrow, so it's today's Yom HaZikaron, which they don't want to make Motzei Shabbos, so they postpone it one day. Does that make sense? Yom HaZikaron comes right before Yom Ha'atzmaut.
Right.
They always push off holidays like this if it's going to start Motzei Shabbos, so that people won't be Mechal Shabbos to set up for a Motzei Shabbos performance or ceremony.
Well, but today is Monday.
Today is Monday,
so
because it had to start
HaZikaron
Sunday night
would have started
instead of Saturday night. Yesterday. If it would have been Sunday,
oh, you're saying it would have been
Saturday
yesterday.
Night.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So Yom HaZikaron should have been yesterday, because Hey Iyar is actually the date of Yom HaZikaron.
I see, okay.
Right now that you said the, even though I wrote it on the paper, but Hey Iyar is Yom HaZikaron.
But today is
so
actually...
But tomorrow will actually be Yom HaZikaron celebrated, because it was pushed off one day because of Shabbos. Because there has to be Yom HaZikaron, which is today.
Right. Yom HaZikaron is today.
Right. So you'll see all kinds of stuff in the internet. You can read articles and think about the soldiers that fell to give us the state of Israel. And we could dedicate our learning to those soldiers. That would be nice.
I think that would be very nice. And all the people. Lots of other people.
Right.
That weren't just soldiers.
Right, for sure. They weren't just soldiers. Lots of people.
Everybody was a soldier or whatever.
Yeah. Who gave their lives, whether gave it through death or through life.
Figuratively.
Yeah, for the state of Israel to exist.
And one thing, just to sort of recap last week a little bit, because I did talk about this, and I thought that it was very interesting that we talked about the perspective from the seller's perspective as well as the buyer's perspective in terms of fairness and all of that. You know, I thought that was... I thought it was interesting that it was broken up into two different mitzvot, looking at it from sort of both sides.
Right, that everybody has a responsibility selling
exactly.
or buying, to be honest, and not to just squeak by. And right, yeah, I remember one time I came home from the shoe store and had four pairs of shoes, and it was $75, and I thought, I did great. Four pairs of shoes for $75. And then I checked the receipt, and they only charged me for three. So I called up this is a long time ago. I called up the store and I told them, and they were like, well, you'll have to come down and pay for it. I'm like, I'm not coming down.
Just charge my credit card.
I have five little kids, you know. So I said, just charge my credit card. Well, we're going to have to see it. I said, no, I'm calling you. I'm telling you. Until I got them to charge it, it really was a hassle. And then I told my husband, who told everybody in the office in Manhattan and his law firm, and they were all like, they couldn't believe it. They're like, what? You know, and I was thinking, it should have been a good story. They should have been thinking, your wife, she's so stupid, she got away with her, right? And she made them charge. It should have been, your wife, she's the religious Jew, look how honest she is. Because unfortunately, they had a lot of opposite stories in the law firm.
That's why they don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, they just didn't know how to process the concept that somebody was honest enough to call the store and pay back.
Duke happens to do that, not infrequently when things arise, and it is always, even now, it's always very confusing. To the salespeople, to the clerks, to the,
what are you doing? Right.
Because it does happen very infrequently.
Yeah. It reflects badly on them.
Well, I guess it sort of, it sort of reflects badly in general on people.
No,
you know,
but
it reflects badly on them that they missed
an item.
Yeah, well.
They might get in trouble with their manager. Who knows what they're thinking.
Last week, was part of that mitzvot about buying and selling, I'm just sort of skimming through it, had anything to do with the fact that... you should not lead a salesperson on if you're not going to buy anything.
That's me today.
Oh, that's today. Okay.
That's going to be today. Well,
which
it is. We know we do have that actually in last week's also, that you're not supposed to. Is that going to be in today? It's included in today, but it's
a huge
also
problem
last
today.
You're not allowed to lead people on.
No, I'm really
these days, it's
that.
A very huge problem with
especially,
the internet.
Yeah, for sure.
Because so many people, again, we don't do this, but so many people go to the store, do all this comparison shopping, figure out exactly what they want, and then go home and save $5 or whatever.
Which you can do if you're not involving somebody. But you can
do on your own.
You can do on your own.
Yes.
You can go look around. And
sure, that's different, though. But if you take somebody's time...
Right.
And they help you, and they give you advice, and they give you directions, and all of that, and then say, okay, thanks, I'll go think about it, and then...
Right. That's not
take
okay.
Because it's like taking their skill, as well as if they, you know, some...
Right. It's called Gnevat dat, stealing their
sort of
thoughts.
Stealing, yeah.
It is stealing.
Yeah.
Stealing their thoughts, it's stealing their time. You're not allowed to do it.
You know, it's an interesting point, because in Europe, people don't even go to stores. They window shop from outside if they don't
want to
buy anything. Here, it's just, you know, it's fine. You know, you can walk. And I'm not talking about big department stores, but little kind of boutique-y things,
right.
Places. People go in, and of course, salesperson would just being polite, engages in conversation.
That's their job.
You don't want to buy anything; you just want to look.
Right.
And so.
So that's why you do have to be very clear. No, I'm just looking, or I just came to look around. You know, I was in an airport store, and they have lots of artsy things. I think it's a mosaic or something like that. It's a lot of artists. And I just wanted to look for ideas. I was not looking to buy. Although there's the slightest possibility that. On a whim, I might, but I was really looking for ideas. So I just told the sales lady as soon as I walked in, she said, oh, can I show you anything? I was like, no, I'm just here. I'm just looking for ideas. I'd like to see the things that you have. So, and I think some people might even say that's not okay because you are getting their hopes up.
Right.
But I think
in
this country, it's okay.
I was going to say,
I think there's a cultural context also.
But in some places, I feel really bad, actually, leaving without buying. It feels uncomfortable.
So right. So in those places, you have to be more careful. You're not even supposed to. I mean, it says in here, I forgot which one it says it in, but it says you're not even really supposed to look at the merchandise if you don't, I mean, like, cast your eyes over.
But
if you don't have any money to buy.
You're not supposed to, like, take it out, feel it, hold it.
No, some people, here it says you shouldn't even look at it. So I think that's cultural context. Because it's not that the look is stealing, but you're getting, the idea is that you're getting the hopes of the seller up. So I don't think in this country it's that way. Like, if you're looking, the person's not thinking, ah, I have a customer.
To buy.
Right? Because everybody knows today the amount of stuff that we have that people look for. But you're certainly not supposed to take somebody's time, and especially to something like comparison shop. If you're gonna, if you know you're planning on buying online, not okay. I'm trying to think about what to do now because I want to buy a car, and I'll probably buy it through the Costco plan. But you have to shop, right? So you have to.
But you know what? They do that with. I don't know
with
if Costco does, but AAA I know for sure does in conjunction with dealers. And so when you go through the whole thing, then they can send you to the dealer, and then you're not, even though you're buying through Costco or AAA or whatever, you're not really,
right,
you know.
Have to find
so you have to find, yeah, you have, I mean,
yeah.
You know,
because
our daughter just
time
did that with
and,
AAA.
Yeah.
And they went and test drove cars and did all kinds of things, and it was very clear they were doing it. So I think if it's clear that that's the avenue that you're following.
Yeah, you know, so I just have to all call Costco.
Yeah, you need to find out.
Okay. 338, the prohibition against oppressing a Jew with words.
So this applies only to Jews.
This one applies only to Jews, right? Of course, we have to be careful and sensitive as people who are being careful and sensitive, but this is a mitzvah d'oraita. Shelo lahanot lahonot echad mi Yisrael bedvarim. Not to oppress any Jew with words. So it starts out with something that could only be Jewish, really. Although I guess you could make up a situation where it would apply to a non-Jew, where you're not allowed to tell a Baal Tshuva, and here it says the word Baal Tshuva, but it really means an actual Baal Tshuva, not the way that we use it today. Somebody who was raised religious, who strayed from the path and became re-religiousized. That's technically what a Baal Tshuva is.
Right. Born
again. You're not allowed to remind him of his errant behavior.
Which would be cruel.
Today, a Baal Tshuva is just somebody who wasn't born into a religious family,
and
who becomes religious later in life.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, it's a new discovery. They don't have to, like, for a Baal Tshuva, an adult, today's Baal Tshuva, they wouldn't necessarily be so embarrassed that they ate bacon in their 20s, because
they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. You know, so they're not going to be cringing, although some do, but most don't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, but somebody who was raised in a from family, and a father's a rabbi, and a mother covered their hair, and then they went and did stuff, and then they, and now they look again like their family, right? So they'll be embarrassed if you say, oh, I remember you.
Seeing you out there eating cheeseburgers.
Right. So they'd be embarrassed because they come from a place where it's embarrassing they did that. So you're not allowed to say it. Not allowed to say it to them. And it's, here's the interesting thing. If afflictions come upon him, a person, one should not tell him, as Job's friends said to him, is not your fear of God your confidence? Meaning, you don't have enough emunah. That's why you're sick. which is amazing. Could you imagine ever saying that to somebody? No. You're suffering? That's obviously because you're a sinner.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I can imagine people saying that. I mean, I can imagine it being said, I should say.
Really?
Yeah. Sure, because people that have that, you know, who are judgmental and critical and you know, view the world through that lens, they're not filtered sometimes, and they would just say it. They wouldn't just think it, they'd say it.
Well, it's a bad thing to say, but I think we all kind of inside hope and want to believe that if we're going to do good, everything is going to be all right.
Which we know is not true.
Right, well, that's
which
true.
Which is not true.
It's true. We do hope and wish that, for sure. But it's another thing to see somebody whose life is messed up in some way.
Of course.
And then tell them it's obviously because they whatever.
It's your own fault. Only you'd been a better whatever.
Right. So we're not permitted to do that. But we're also not permitted to tell a merchant. So here we go.
It's on the next page.
Right. Yeah. So we're not supposed to, first of all, we're not supposed to tell somebody to go somewhere where we know they don't sell something. So let's say it has the example. Somebody is looking for grain or whatever feed for their donkey, and you don't know where it's sold. But you just say, you know, go down to Woolworth. They sell it, just to get them out of your way. And they don't, so you can't do that. That's called oppressing, even though that's really leading astray, but that's called oppressing someone with words. Nor should one ask a merchant, how much is this, when he does not wish to buy.
Where are you? Oh,
so
I see
the
it up
top
there
paragraph,
at the top.
Right? Mm-hmm. Right? So you want to promote peace among human beings, and great is peace, for through it, blessing is found in the world. While contention is harsh, so many maledictions and misfortunes devolve from it. So it's interesting here it's saying that it may be true that your sickness, right, comes from what you did, if you understand these words that he just said, but you're not supposed to say it.
Well, and I think that it, farther on down it says, wronging with words is more serious than wronging with property or actions.
Isn't that interesting? Because it can't be fixed.
If you can't take, in other words, once you've heard something,
right, you can't really fix
it. It's hard to take
it
back.
It's like the famous parable. One of the rabbis said, the guy came and said, I've done this great, you know, Lashon Hara thing. And the rabbi says, here, okay, take this pillow, scatter all the feathers, and you'll be fine. So the guy scatters all the feathers and comes back and says, okay, I've done it, rabbi. He says, no, now you have to go back and get all the feathers from the pillow. Because that's how your words go out into the world.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't possibly bring it back.
I mean, it's just...
Right, so you, whatever, hurt somebody's property, pour poison on their grass. Okay, so you can figure
fix
that
it,
you can
replace
fix
it. Whatever.
Replace it, you'll dig it out, you'll replace it, you put a new soil, you put a new seed, you'll fix it. But you hurt somebody's feelings and you can't fully fix that.
I think that's one reason why it's so difficult when you see, you know, the bullying that goes on in school and the way that kids frequently talk to one another and stuff like that, because those are wounds that go in and they're
deep.
They
do, and they stick.
They do, and people, you know, they internalize them, and they, especially children, they believe it. Mm-hmm. They believe it, even though it may have no evidence or bearing in truth at all. If you say something, people tend to believe it. And for whatever reason, it's almost like you believe it more if it's negative. I mean, which is sort of, it's not logical necessarily.
Right.
But if somebody says something, oh, you look so pretty, you go, oh, well, you know, whatever. Right. But if they go, gee, you know, it looks a little like you've gained a little weight, or whatever, you immediately believe it.
Right. That's true. I have Israeli friends who are, they're not at all, like, I mean, they're not like Americans that are sensitive. Israelis are much more, like, to the point. And they're, like, straight up, Lisa, you got fat. Like,
thanks. Thank you. Hello.
I should. So, it's just straight up, yeah. But in Israel, I guess that's considered okay. I mean, there are cultural
probably
things.
Probably, you know? Yeah. Well,
that's just considered an observation. It's not an insult.
Like the rest of us.
Right? Yeah, it depends on how we think. Like, my daughter, one of her husband's many relatives, when they visited, said to her, you're so thin. They're Russian, right? It's a whole Russian family. They said, you're so thin. She said, thank you. They said, it's not a compliment.
Well, for most of history, it wasn't a compliment because it meant that you didn't have enough
letting
food.
Her know. She was so happy. Thank you.
Not that.
That's funny.
Have some chocolate.
Yeah.
Okay. So here it's important to see it's impossible. It would not be possible to write in detail all the words that could bring pain to people. Rather, everyone needs to take care according to what he sees. For the eternal Lord, blessed is he, knows all his steps and all his hints. For man looks on the outward appearance, but he looks on the heart. Our sages of blessed memory wrote many tales for us in the Midrashim to teach us ethical lessons about this. The main part of the subject, though, is where you can find it in Bava Metzia, chapter 4. So this paragraph is telling us that it's culturally based also. You can't possibly write it because what insults in one language, you're so thin, right, is a compliment in another. So it really depends on the context that you're in. You know, you're such a great cook could also be like, what? You know, I'm a great scientist. Cooking is just to put food on the table, you know, whereas somebody else wants to be a great cook. So it really depends on the context, and we have to be careful in the context in which we speak to not harm somebody with words. And it's in effect everywhere and every time for both men and women. Even here, it says, even towards a man's own sons and daughters and members of his household, it says that you're not allowed to inflict harm with words except toward young children, who it is right to take care not to pain them unduly with words, but you sometimes have to, so that they should learn ethics and morals, right? So sometimes you have to say something to them that will hurt their feelings. But it says, he who's lenient with them and not to inflict pain on them in these ways will find life, blessing, and honor. So this is very important to see here in 13th century Spain. So at the time it's Christian, right? When did the Muslims take over? I'm trying to think, when was Spain Muslim?
Oh, that was more in the 1500s.
No, it was before that because 1492 was the
Spanish
was
expulsion.
Right.
That was probably around 8th century.
I would say, yeah.
9th century?
Yeah, 800, 900, somewhere like that. Yeah. I just remember 1492 was the Inquisition.
640 was the beginning of Islam. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when did they spread to Spain? Right away?
Like Northern Africa. Through Morocco, they came from, the Moors came from Morocco to Spain.
And I don't even know if it was culturally the thing at the time, but I know culturally had, now with Muslims, there is a lot of painting of children and women.
Vandals there. That's why Muslims called it Andalusia. It's from the word Vandals.
Vandals. Oh, really?
They were the tribes of pagans. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so here you have in this ancient context whether there was a Muslim influence or here. I think it's mostly the Christian world that he's living
Christian
in. But the point is not to hurt somebody with words, and that we do have to be sensitive even to our charges, we could either think of our children and our household members as our charges so that we are required to instruct them properly, or as our property in a way that we can
treat it well.
We could treat them more lightly and without such thought as we would treat a guest or somebody like that. But he's saying even members of our household, we have to treat very carefully. And even if we do have to instruct them to be lenient in the harshness, give them instruction without being harsh, we should not pain them with words. That's important. Let's see. If you spoke inappropriately, top of page 411, there are no whiplashes for it, so the punishment is not physical because it's not a physical action, even though words seem physical, but it's not a physical action. However, you will suffer by the hands of God, not by the hands of a whip here on earth. And let's see what I write here.
So, but this is also interesting. Then he has this whole thing about whether you have to take it in silence or whether you can respond in it. I just saw the movie 42.
I saw it this weekend.
And
too. Yeah.
It was one of the things that Jackie Robinson had to do was basically take it. You know, people were slurring, you know, saying the worst possible things. And I read something that the movie totally downplayed what was said to him. And he had to just take it. He couldn't respond, at least for the first couple years, until he was a little more established. And this sort of talks about.
But that's a little bit different because he's taking it for the sake of his career advancement in the context of a country in which he recognizes, although it's extremely painful, that that's the environment of racism in which he lives. And in order to make headway, in a way, it's sort of like that scene in Lincoln, right? In order to make headway, you have to sometimes push a little less so that you can get your agenda forward.
Yeah.
You know, so you'll make actual headway without breaking the right. momentum that you could have because
you had
because being right
or,
is so important, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so. Right. So this is right. So it does talk about not responding, and we do have that phrase which we've discussed before: aluv ha'aluv ve'eino ne'alav, the one who's insulted and doesn't take insult. Shomea cherpato ve'eino mashiv, the one who hears his cherpa. How do you say cherpa? Humiliation. Excuse me, and does not reply. Hears disgrace and does not reply. And then there's a third one, because the three, he's referring only to two. And the third one is Hamekabel Yisurim Ba'ahava, who receives suffering with love. Kitzei Teshamesh Begvurato is like the sun that comes out in its zenith. They're beloved of Hashem. Ohavav Kitzei Teshamesh Begvurato. They're beloved of Hashem. Like the sun in its zenith. So that's, if we talk about shining the light and being Jews who are supposed to shine, so here's the shiniest you could get, is like the sun in its zenith, if you could behave in these ways. So I think part of behaving in this way is really coming into touch with your own deep sense of self-esteem, so that you don't have to respond. You're not even necessarily defending yourself, because it's not necessary. What you're hearing is just, I mean, in a way, think about how you would feel if, what's that church that travels around and insults people and came to Dot and set up a whole thing and they go and demonstrate at soldiers' funerals.
Yeah, I know. It's some,
those
yeah.
mean people. Yeah. Right, so let's say they stood outside the JCC this morning and said, "You're learning Torah, you're terrible people, you're going to burn in hell," right? So you'd walk past them and think, "You guys are pathetic."
Right, what do they know?
You wouldn't even need to respond to that.
Right.
You wouldn't say, "No, my Torah learning is important." Right? Like, you're so anchored
right.
in the truth of what you're doing and the ridiculousness of what they're saying, even though they're trying very hard to hurdle insults. But it's so clear there that you don't have to respond, because it's just so ridiculous. So we have to take an example like that and be able to bring it back to when it does hurt, because it's a little closer or feels a little bit more real, to understand, you know what, you don't. You can be anchored strong enough in who you are that you don't have to respond to that. And somebody who's like that, who's so deeply anchored, that's where they're Kitzei Teshemesh Begvurato, where they are like the sun shining in its zenith. So it's not just being quiet, which is a strong thing. So Jackie Robinson, who's able to be quiet in order to advance, in this
whatever.
Case, his race, whatever you want to call it, there, like in the
in
movie,
that
that's
context,
what it would be,
right?
I didn't, in that context, yeah. And see the movie, it sounds interesting.
I really liked it.
Yeah, sounds interesting. But in order, he had an agenda, right? So he
right.
had
it was
to
more
do,
than just himself. That
right, he had to do what
of.
Was necessary right. for his agenda to move forward, whether it would be personal advancement or communal advancement.
It would be the same.
You know? I mean, there
similar.
Are people who, so there are times to take it and times not to take it. I think, depending on what's going on. But you could imagine also in Russia, certain Jews had to take certain things in order
sure.
to manage. And Sharansky, you know. He was amazing.
For sure.
Even when he was released, and they told him, "Walk straight across that bridge and don't look back." He walked in a zigzag. Like,
just because.
Like,
just because.
I am not listening to you. I don't care what you say.
Right.
I don't care if you take me back to prison. You say walk straight, I'm walking
in a zigzag.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. So, yeah.
I remember that. That's funny. I hadn't
right.
thought about that in a million years.
Yeah. Yeah, Yosef Mendelevich is coming to St. Louis to speak. I saw on the
really.
Yeah, I would love to hear him speak. I wonder if he would come here. But I was in Israel the day that he was released, and it was such an amazing thing. I can't even. It was like one of those moments in my life that is just etched so strongly. But you know, he was a prisoner of Zion for so long, and so many people davened for him to get out, and he suffered so much. And finally, when he's released, that it was in Israel. It was 1981 or two, because I was in Bravender's then. And buses just appeared on the streets. Just appeared. Like, all of a sudden, there's school buses and city buses, and they were just there. And the schools emptied out, and the apartment buildings emptied out, and everybody just got on buses. No fare, no nothing. Just got on buses, and, like, the whole Israel drove to Ben-Gurion Airport. And the tarmac was covered with a sea of Jews. The whole tarmac was covered.
Wow.
So by the time the plane came in, he got started to walk down the steps, because there's no jetways in those days, right? He was walking down the steps. He never even hit the ground. He went straight onto the shoulders of people who were dancing and carrying him through. It was, like, amazing to be there. Just an amazing experience. So, anyway, right. There are times taken, times not to take it, but...
I didn't know any of that. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Can't imagine. Cannot imagine. Yeah, well, it's like to me in such a tight... I mean, I was thinking about, you know, the elections in Venezuela and what people are choosing and how foolish they are to choose it. And are they really choosing and is that really a choice and all that stuff. Okay. So let's just see if we could do another thing about Onat Devarim, not hurting people with the words. I learned from Debbie Greenblatt when I learned this whole... I used to go to her Shmira Saleshan classes. And she spent probably... I think months on this one mitzvah and how it applies. But before she started to teach it, she did say, she cautioned us and said that now that we're going to learn these halachas, you might get your feelings hurt a little more often than you used to. Because as you learn extra levels of sensitivity, you'll realize sometimes how insensitive some people are, what they say.
That's an interesting statement. I think that's very true.
It was interesting just to see that and just to realize how careful we should be. I was thinking about there's somebody who cooks in our community and sells food. So, and I thought about later, Donnie likes our chicken cutlets, but they don't have enough salt for him. He adds a lot of salt. So the next time I ordered, I said, do you mind putting on some more salt? And then I thought, maybe that like hurts her feelings. Maybe better he should just salt it. You know, like maybe I shouldn't say, you know, could you put more salt? I'm still ordering it, but I don't want to hurt her feelings. You know, so it depends on like how.
Always add salt.
Right, exactly. That's what I was thinking. Maybe I shouldn't have asked her to, because then she might feel that her cooking is not adequate. Because adding salt's very easy. You know.
So, political correctness also comes from Jews.
Some of it probably does, right? Yeah, so I think you could take it overboard in terms of political correctness, which would be incorrect to go that far. Yeah, it's interesting. There's a new blog on NPR I heard about this morning called Code Switch.
Oh, I was listening.
Were you listening
Code
to that?
Switch?
Code Switch, yeah. And I was thinking about that because it said that you kind of lapse, when you're sort of comfortable or something, you kind of lapse into sort of the way, the vernacular, the way you were raised, or, you know, things that you say in private, you're necessarily saying in public when you're with a public face. So I was thinking, I should call up and say that, and usually when I'm in a group like this, I say Baruch Hashem, but I never say it in the
real
community.
That's for sure a code switch.
Exactly.
For sure. Yeah. And actually, as Jews, we are directed to speak Jewish. We're supposed to speak a Jewish language. Mm. So I remember in the bungalows, a few of the very from Brooklyn-y ladies discussing, like, how is it that we speak English? Isn't that usher? We're supposed to speak a Jewish language. And the Jews in Egypt were saved because they kept their language. So how are we today thinking that we're religious and we're speaking English? So somebody answered her and said, actually, we speak Jewish. Because the way that we speak English is so Jewish that we actually have to change it when we're speaking to Gentiles or to non-Orthodox Jews. She said, so if you speak a language that's Jewish enough that you have to be conscious when you're speaking to somebody who's not Jewish to change it, then you are speaking Jewish and you're permitted to speak the way that you speak.
Yeah. That was a good response.
So that is part of the code switching, because we do speak differently. So whether we say Yerush Alayim or Baruch Hashem or Neshama or words like that, and you have to be very conscious to switch your language.
Exactly.
Right. I usually just say it to myself, but if somebody says something. Something like,
I more say it to myself.
Because I said once, God will, and I said it in English in a work situation.
And people looked at you like, huh?
I said, God willing. And he looked at me and said, what are you, Muslim?
Well, you could be. You have darkish hair.
You could say, inshallah. Well, that's what Miriam, I love Miriam's expressions. She has the best expressions. So she'll say, the good Lord willing and the creek don't rise. Right?
Yeah. Which is a very southern thing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. She has a lot of those. I spoke about one politician. She's like, that politician, I forgot who it was. He's crooked as a dog's hind leg. She always has good ones. Okay. The prohibition against selling a field permanently in the land of Israel. So as we discussed earlier in Mitzvah 330, which is the Mitzvah of Yovel, let's see, where is that? Back here. To count seven cycles, that's the Mitzvah of this counting, and what the point of it is, and the Yovel, the root of the precept, so I'll just read this. The root of the precept from the aspect of plain meaning lies the reason that the Eternal Lord desired to convey to his people that everything is his, and ultimately, everything will return to whoever he wished to give it originally, because the earth is his, as it is written, for the land is mine, in Leviticus 25:23. Then with this precept of counting every year, people will keep well away from seizing the land of their fellow men by robbery, or even desiring it in their heart, knowing that all returns to the one whom God wishes to have it. So this Leviticus 25:23 is what we're looking at right now. The prohibition against selling the field permanently in the land of Israel. So we do understand that everything, all land belongs to God, and that's very important in thinking about the land of Israel, that we're just entrusted with that land. We're permitted to live on that land, but we don't actually own that land. God owns it, and he apportions it to different families and tribes. And they get to live on that piece, but it doesn't even belong to them, because enough that they could sell it. It's not theirs that they can then sell it. They can sell it for a short period of time if they have to. The minimum amount of time is 2 years, because it talks about years, so minimum of years with an S is two. But after 2 years, anybody in the family who has enough money to redeem the land can redeem it, and the owner of the land, the temporary owner of the land, can't oppose the sale. If somebody wants to buy it back into the family, it gets bought back into the family. So you can't. Buyer and seller can't, but they also mayn't sell it forever, so in perpetuity. So if somebody would transgress the mayn't and make a sale that's a forever sale, then the sale wouldn't be binding because they can't do it. But if they just transgress the may part and they make that sale whether or not they can, they would be transgressing this, and they would be punished for that.
Well, so what about the Cave of Machpelah?
That was before...
It was bought.
But that was before the land was divided out.
Okay, I mean, because that's basically in perpetuity.
Yes,
that's,
it is. Yeah. It is. So you can't. So that was, first of all, before the land was apportioned. That was Abraham bought that, mm-hmm. right, from... Ephron. Right. So Abraham bought that. Mm-hmm. 400 shekel. Yeah, it's an interesting thing that it's recorded in the amount also, and the whole dealing. It's such an Arab dealing, mm-hmm. even for them.
Like, how it is.
It's amazing, yeah. right? Yeah. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
He bought it, and that was in perpetuity, and usually when you buy land, it is forever.
And isn't the land on the Temple Mount, wasn't that purchased too?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But so things like that can be purchased, but who are they owned by? Who is it owned by? Like, nobody, who owns? I don't know the answer to this, actually. Who owns Ma'arat HaMachpelah today, the Cave of the Patriarchs? I mean, it's probably owned by the State of Israel, would be my guess.
Yeah, but you can barely go there.
Right, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about legally.
Well, if you have an armored car,
right.
you can go there.
I've been there.
I was there last year, but it was very scary.
Yeah, it's petrifying.
And the soldiers at the end.
Oh, yeah, they should have soldiers all the way through the streets.
I mean, now don't they go
I have a friend who lives in Kiryat Arba.
Really?
Hebron has Jewish people.
Hebron is scary to live in. That's only very brave.
I remember the taxi driver that took us to Kiryat Arba.
Yeah,
he's so eager to get out of there.
Oh yeah,
I'm sure. It's not. You take a wrong turn, and you could be torn apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not. You know,
it's not false fear.
Yeah, no, it's not even like going to Harlem. You know, like I remember when I first came to New York in the early '80s, like '84. So I was told, like, if you are
on the
subway,
whatever.
You're on the subway and you get lost in your book and you're reading, and all of a sudden you're at whatever address, do not get off.
To go back.
Just
keep going.
Keep going, or get in a cab immediately, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, do not walk in the neighborhood. Do not ask for directions. Get out. Right? It's not the case today. But even there, so you're just scared of being killed, not being torn apart and tortured like you would be in Hebron. You know, literally drawn and quartered, it's much easier to get shot than to be killed that way. Nobody wants to be killed, but I'm just saying, like, it's... Well, people who live there are very idealistic and a little bit crazy, hopefully in a positive sense. You have to be a little bit crazy. Think about it. If you are living there with your children, it's one thing to put your own life on the line. You know, you're 18, 19, 20, 25, and nuts, young adult, you do whatever you want. Once you have children and you're willing to put their life on the line, that's a little bit nuts. We do have to have people who are that nuts in the world. But it is a little bit, you know, to be willing to raise your children in an environment like that where their life
is on the
line.
Knowing that the danger is real.
All the time. You know, that when they play, going to school, whatever it is, that you're all the time, your life is on the line.
All these settlements of you have the same problem.
Yeah, yeah, you do. So people are very idealistic. Right, so buying land in perpetuity, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens. We're past this right now because we don't know what land belongs to whom anymore or who belongs to what tribe and who owns what. So we're well beyond it. I don't know if it's going to revert, you know, when we finally detangle all this and Mashiach comes. Will there be that? It's possible where all land will revert, or will it be a whole different way of dealing with it? I mean, even thinking about, I mean, I don't know if you could make it this way, and I don't want to make any political statements. I'm just musing aloud, just, right? If we think about such a thing as the Jewish National Fund, with all of us contributing all around the world and that money being used to purchase the land, in a way it does belong to all of us, right? It makes it so that the land doesn't belong to any one Jew, even though some people now can buy pieces, but that money was used to purchase the land back from Arabs who lived there to make it into Jewish land. And it's just Jewish land, right? Those forests and things, so maybe they're owned by the state, but the state is owned by us in a way, right. And it's Jewish.
It's not an individual.
Right. So again, just musing, I don't know exactly how it all works, and if there's corruption and all that stuff, I don't know. But there is such a concept that, you know, everybody contributed to help repurchase the land, even though the land was given to us by God. But in the current, this current era of history,
it had to be
repurchased. And it wasn't mostly purchased by individuals, it was mostly purchased by the collective Jewish people to make it part of the state. And I don't know how it works in Israel, if you can buy land or if you just lease it. Land lease it.
And buy property.
Yeah, but I don't...
You may not be buying the land that the building is on.
Right. I don't know.
Even here, you may not be buying the
right,
land.
There are places here where you're not. And here we have all kinds of laws. Like you might even buy the land, but not the water underneath it.
Yeah.
Right? So, or the mineral rights.
The mineral
right. So we do have concepts of ownership only extending so far. And even in Lowry, there's some houses that you can buy on a land lease. You don't own the land. You just own it for 99 years. So you can sell the remainder of the 99 years in your... underneath your condo, but you only are buying it for 99 years. So I don't know how it works in Israel, if there's anything based on this today. But the point of this as a mitzvah is that we should realize the land belongs to Hashem. It doesn't belong to people. Hashem gets to apportion it how he wants. We're entrusted with its care, and every 50 years there's a reversion back to who it's supposed to belong to, so that it remains in the shape that Hashem wants it to remain in. And you can sell it for certain periods of time, but you're basically, it's just a lease. And here it gives a specific example of how you're permitted to, the one way you can get out of it not reverting during the Jubilee, which is the next mitzvah 340, the precept of returning land to its original owner at the Yovel, at the Jubilee, you're not allowed to sell your land in perpetuity. You can't just say, you buy this land forever, it belongs to you. But you could say, you buy this land for 60 years, which will be longer than the Jubilee. Right? So you can do that. Then you won't be transgressing 349, but you will be transgressing 340 because it's supposed to revert.
Right,
so 340, let's look at that. The precept of returning land to its original owner at the Yovel, at the Jubilee, to return all landed properties, whether a house, a field, a vineyard, or an orchard in the Jubilee year to their owners without payment of money or any other price. Right, so it just goes back. They don't have to buy it, so they don't have to have the money for that. And in all the land of your possession, you shall grant a redemption for the land. That's Leviticus 25:24. In other words, in all the land of Israel, which is your heritage possession, you shall provide redemption for the land. And Scripture explained the meaning of redemption, that it denotes the reversion of landed property to its original owner. As is written, in this year of Jubilee you shall return every man to his heritage possession. So that's just to remind us of what it says in 330, that the land belongs to God, and it all reverts. So it's interesting to think about the reverting. And I just wonder how that... I'm just having a new thought here, so again, just thinking out loud. If Judaism itself is based on the ability to renew and remake yourself all the time, but it's interesting just to think about the juxtaposition of that, and I don't have this thought worked out at all, but you can't do that to
right.
the land.
Yeah.
Right. The land belongs to who it belongs to,
who it belongs to,
and that's all it is. It belongs to that to whom it belongs. And
can't
actually
over.
Be changed, right? So it can revert to ownership, but it can't be shifted or, you know, brought to new hands for new leadership. It stays in that family. Whereas who we are can be constantly changed. That's been given into our hands, that we can constantly choose who we want to be and how we want to make ourselves. And we can shift ourselves around again and again and again. But the land, even if you shift it around, her...
Always goes back.
Always goes back. Yeah.
And in practicality, how does that work now? Or you don't really know.
Right, so now that's what I'm saying. I don't think this applies now. I wonder if it applies to houses somehow, but I don't... It's interesting because it does apply to houses also. So here it has on the bottom of 421. It talks about... so here's a couple of things. Okay, so in the middle of page 421. So it talks about if a house is in a walled city, right? So if it's sold in a walled city, he's able to buy it back. The sale can revert within a year. It becomes permanent after a certain amount of time. It's irrevocable after a certain amount of time, after the second year. But the first year, he can buy it back at any time. So if somebody has to sell their house... So it's also a different culture than we're thinking of. People don't just sell their houses to move to another city. They sell their house because they've fallen on such hard times, they don't have enough money for food. But if they gather up enough money and they can rebuy their house, then they can buy it back. What if the person who owns the house likes that location and doesn't want to sell it back? They might be feeling sneaky and say, you know what, I'm going to buy the house, I'm going to lock it up, I'll live somewhere else for the year, so that if he gets enough money to buy it back, then I won't be there for him to buy it from. And so he can't buy it back from me, and then I'll come back only when the sale's permanent. Right? Somebody could think that. So there's actually a remedy for that. If you gather up enough money to buy the house, you can deposit the money with the Beit Din, break the door, and start living in your house. It's your house. You get to buy it back. And whenever they return to town, they can take the money from the Beit Din. You've already paid it. You put it in escrow, basically, for when the person who bought the house from you returns, but you get to buy it back whether or not they're there. It doesn't have to do with their agreement or their presence. So that's interesting to think about. Let's see, where did I want to see if so then it has to do with walled cities and unwalled cities, and then there's only certain walled cities where it makes a difference and certain walled cities where it doesn't, and if the house was built and then the wall was built around, or if the wall was built first and then the house was built inside, there's all kinds of different things today. It may possibly apply in the old city of Jerusalem, something.
Well, I was
going to
say, who follows these laws?
Well, that's what I was
like
just...
Like the Sotmer, you know, the
Oh, nobody religion? Would follow these laws today because...
No?
It, because let's look at the end of it, right? On the bottom of page 423, the rest of its details are in the tractate Arachin. It applies to both men and women in the land of Israel at the time that the law of the Jubilee is observed, right, which is not now. And I have previously written above in 330, at which time the Jubilee is in effect, i.e. when all the Israelites are on their land in their settlements. So it doesn't apply today because we don't have all the Israelites in the land of Israel on their settlements.
Do we keep track of Jubilee years? Is it always at
I
loss?
Think so. No, because we have the Shemitah years. So I'm not positive if we know when the Jubilee is, because it does come at the end of seven Shemitahs, but we do know when the Shemitahs are, so I'm guessing we know when the Jubilee is, and I don't know how we observe that.
Didn't they just recently have a Jubilee?
I'm not sure. I just don't know if they did or not. It would be interesting to know. And do they observe that with the Shemitah? How that works? Or do they do two Shemitah years in a row? I don't know. If they recently had one...
It seems to me that
I know they had a Shemitah.
Do that.
Well, that's every 7 years. But like,
Jubilee's every 50 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the state of Israel is only
49 years, the 7th year.
65.
Right, so it's possible that there's been two since the state.
And
possible.
What was the first time, when do we count from the Jubilee year? Which
right,
year
that's what we're saying.
From?
We don't know.
I don't know. It could be from when we entered the land.
Somebody can
with
ask
Jericho.
Their phone.
Yeah, somebody ask your phone. Phones know these things. They're amazing.
It's a great Google question.
Right, it is.
You know, one famous story of land purchase in Jerusalem when I was there last fall. The Jews lived in the early 19th century, I think it was, only within the walls of
right.
the old city. and they were really poor. And Moses Montefiore bought this land
outside,
and they put the windmill, and he thought that that would be the source of livelihood. But it is now one of the most expensive real estate.
Right, exactly. And those houses that are there,
Where the windmill is.
You mean Moshe.
Our tour guide took us through that
neighborhood.
It's a tiny neighborhood.
It's a little enclave, right?
Right behind King David.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Very close to King David Hotel. And some people don't, well, most of the people who own these houses don't even live there year round. They come maybe for Pesach. So.
Well, now that's what Jerusalem has really turned into, a lot of foreign ownership and made it very difficult to purchase.
So I wonder if these people know that they don't really own this.
Okay, so it says here, I mean, I don't know the source, but it says that the last Jubilee year occurred from September 24th, 1966 to October 13th, 1967. Therefore, the next one will be 2015 to 2016.
Oh, soon. That's interesting. Yes, we'll see what that looks like.
Yeah.
Well, I'm pretty much guaranteed that the people didn't all give their land back.
Right.
Pretty much guaranteed that didn't happen.
Well, because the majority of the Jews didn't live there now. But it'll be interesting to see in 2 years, because we do have, I think, the largest Jewish community is in Israel now. There's more Jews in Israel than there
are everywhere else in the diaspora.
I'm not sure if it's more than half the Jews. I don't think we've gotten to that. But the largest community, meaning there's more Jews in Israel than there are in the United States.
Okay.
And so this was the biggest community. But now they've crossed the 6 million mark, and we've dipped below the 5.5 million
mark.
But
if you added everybody everywhere.
You're talking about
what I'm saying. They have the they have the largest community in the world.
Right.
But I still don't think they have half
of all the...
Right, so they don't have the majority of the Jews yet in the land of Israel. But they have the largest community now.
Gotcha.
So, but it's possible that in a couple of years that may switch. You know, that it is continually receiving, and people are unfortunately continuing to assimilate and drop out and leave their countries and make aliyah. So... we'll see what happens. It could be that by this next Jubilee coming up,
it would be
interesting.
This would be very interesting, just in terms of how it's reconciled. I mean, if one were to make the assumption, let's say not even now, but at some point it were to apply, how would that work? What would it look like?
Right.
I mean,
I think you'll need Mashiach to figure that out.
I would say, because if it goes back, because it says something in here about even if it's been resold, it still goes back to the original.
But who knows who's who?
That's what I'm saying.
But that's the problem. Who knows who's from the tribe of Gad and the tribe of Naphtali and the tribe? Like, we all call ourselves We all call ourselves Yehudim now, right? From the tribe of Yehuda, we just all claim. But we know that we're not all members of that tribe. But today, the only distinction we make is Yehuda and Levi. That's it. Those two tribes. And Kohanim being a subset of Levi. So we just, those are the only ones that we... So we'll see what happens if we retribalize or if we transcend tribes.
So here it says, Haredi authorities generally follow the view of the Hashanish that the Shemitah continues to be a biblical obligation.
So Shemitah is,
but, you know, Jubilee. 7 times 7 is 49, so...
So we'll see what Jubilee is. Yeah. What does it say about the Jubilee?
Just what, you know, what I said, those dates. Let's see.
Which website are you looking at?
I just Googled, you know, when is the Jubilee year in Israel.
You could find stuff on Wikipedia. It's crazy. Yeah. It's really amazing.
Who puts all this stuff in there?
People.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem, because you don't know.
Anything,
I mean, you can read
that. Anything you look up may not be.
It's like, well, but usually a Wikipedia article says that. You don't know on some other websites, but Wikipedia is pretty well edited.
Yeah,
so
this
do flag things that don't have enough sources on them, or if it's too short, or they'll put a little thing that this needs to be cleaned up.
Right.
So what they're inviting somebody else who knows more to clean it up.
It says you're looking on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting.
There's
the collective.
A lot of stuff
there's probably others who have something on the subject, too, though.
Yeah, sure. But it's pretty amazing what's on Wikipedia, and then sources and they'll send you different places. Yeah, it's... Well, anyway, it's coming. I heard about some high school kid who was brought into, or college freshman were brought into somebody's library, and they saw the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I said, what is that? So they explained to them what encyclopedia is. And she said, you mean they printed the whole thing out?
Amazing. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it is.
Just think how expensive it would have been if you had to print it all out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, Encyclopedia Britannica was expensive.
It was expensive.
Day. Yeah. Yeah. So that's basically it for today. Okay. So we have these things and how it applies to different things. And if a house is too small, like it's interesting here that a house that does not measure four cubits
really
by four
little.
Cubits is not called a house. Okay. So Japanese houses don't count, right? The ones they have that they sell today in Midtown, wherever Japan is.
Right? And also the new ones in New York City, even, that are like closets.
Yeah. Right, those tiny little closets. They don't count as houses, so apparently they don't revert. But it's just interesting to see the different things. And I think, and I would just be curious, if anybody knows anybody who lives in the Old City, just do some homework and ask. I don't know somebody. I don't think I know anybody who lives in the Old City.
I don't know anybody who lives in the Old City.
But I think there is something about not being able to purchase the Old City land.
It's all on lease.
It's all on land lease or
something. Well, you know, that's true. Is it Hawaii? I mean, there's... I'm trying to think. I remember from when I was practicing law. I think it's Hawaii, but I'm not... I won't swear to it, where all the land is leased. Uh-huh. I mean, they just... I don't know who owns it, but it's all on long-term leases. They never transfer title like we do here with a deed, where theoretically you're transferring ownership at it, you know, forever.
Right, and I could see that. If you believe that your land is your heritage, you know, let's say you're Hawaiian or Indian,
that you would
in
not,
reservation or something, that, that you could be entrusted with taking care of it for a certain period of time.
But you can't really
But you
get,
can't own
right.
it because
and
you
And I
want
think
to.
That's a little bit, you know...
The Hawaiian thing. So we'll just finish up here on page 425. If someone violated this and retained the landed property that he held, not returning it to its original owner, he would thus disobey this positive precept, and his punishment would be very great, as though he had denied the scriptural account of creation.
Wow.
Right? Because that's the
serious?
Sevens are about creation and about recognizing that Shem's in charge of all. If he made it all, he can own it all, he can apportion it all, he gets to pick who owns it. That's the part of the point of the fact that he created it. And so if we don't recognize the ownership and pass it back to the one who actually owns it, according to God saying who owns it, then we deny the fact that God created it, owns it, and gets to rule it. So, right, so that's a big deal. Okay. And there we go. Next week,
welcome
we'll
back.
Continue on. Thank you very much. And
thank you.